Good evening and welcome to Tisky Sour on the fifth Friday night of the third lockdown. Dahlia, how has your week been?
Oh, it's been okay. I feel like this lockdown has gotten easier since I've abandoned like all pretense of functional life. Like, you won't catch me in a bra in like third lockdown. And I'm eating whatever I want to eat. I'm like letting myself have whatever I need to have. So that's improved it slightly.
Great. Dahlia's had a relaxed week. I have to say I've had a fairly relaxed week. Someone's had a stressed week. This week hasn't gone very well for someone. It's Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer has had probably the most difficult week of his leadership. Lots of people who've been going light on him for months are suddenly starting to ask very serious questions about his leadership. That's going to be our main story for tonight. We also have some really important stories. You know, no sort of Piers Morgan shouting at XYZ MP. We're talking about Indian farmers, one of the biggest protests in the world ever, apparently, against reforms to the agricultural sector there. I've got a great interview lined up, and we're going to talk about Boris Johnson humiliating himself by approving a coal mine just as he is pitching Britain as the most forward-thinking country when it comes to climate change. At the end, we do have a bit of a silly story for you, which is a blow-up in a parish council. I'm sure you've seen the video. Millions of people have. One of the best TV events or on-screen events, I suppose, of 2021 so far. Keir Starmer has perhaps had the worst week of his leadership so far. And after getting a relatively easy ride from the press and Labour MPs up to this point, the knives are apparently out. The flare-up started after a leak in The Guardian revealed a strategy to make Keir increase his authority by performatively standing in front of flags. This enraged many on the left while provoking ridicule from the right. For some examples, across the political spectrum, Clive Lewis in The Guardian argued Starmer's 1950s-style caricature of patriotism was both dangerous and phony. You might have seen Clive Lewis on Wednesday making a similar argument on Tisky Sour. It wasn't just in the pages of The Guardian that people were complaining, though. This is Suzanne Moore in The Telegraph. She argued that empty patriotic gestures could not substitute for vision. This seems to be the biggest complaint about Keir Starmer at the moment. There was a BBC article, in fact, actually just before we went live, saying Labour is in search of a vision. It's not the best headline to have in the BBC. We can go to one more uncomfortable headline for Keir Starmer. This is Rod Little in The Sun, not someone whose opinions we should take particularly seriously, but he says no one would be fooled by Keir Starmer's new patriotic Labour Party. The fact of that presentation getting leaked on one of the issues which Keir Starmer is particularly uncomfortable on, both patriotism, which he thinks Labour has a problem with, but also on being a little bit fake. That's not exactly what you want out into the public domain. And then, to add insult to injury, the leak, which presumably Keir Starmer can't be blamed for, was followed by an unforced error in the House of Commons. In a response to a jibe from Boris Johnson about Starmer's support for staying in the European Medicines Agency, the Labour leader cried foul, only to be caught out. It provided material for this Tory attack ad.
Well, all of this, of course, is to allow us to get on with the vaccination programme. And if it had listened to the Right Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, we would still be at the starting blocks because he wanted to stay in the European Medicines Agency, Mr. Speaker, and said so four times from that dispatch box.
Keir Starmer.
Complete nonsense. Don't let the truth get in the way of a pre-prepared gag. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister knows I've never said that from this dispatch box or anywhere else, but
why would we want to be outside of the European Medicines Agency, which ensures all medicines in the EU are safe and effective?
Mr. Speaker, let me give three without the details. The European Aviation Safety Agency, which deals with safety, the European Medicines Agency, and of course Europol, which I worked with for many years. These are the bits of the EU which we should be seeking to retain, not to throw away. We will also seek to maintain membership or equivalent relations with European organisations which offer benefits to the EU, such as Euratom, the European Medicines Agency, Europol and Eurojust.
Now, that's not the kind of video Keir Starmer wants to be going viral, especially when he is trying to distance himself from his previous enthusiasm for the European Union and support for a vote to overturn the 2016 referendum. However, perhaps most worryingly for Keir Starmer was a piece by Stephen Bush in the New Statesman. Now, Stephen Bush is one of the most prominent Labour commentators currently working in the British press and also quite sympathetic to the party's current leader. So the piece was headlined, "A consensus is forming among the commentariat that Keir Starmer is not up to the job. Does it matter?" Now, Bush is relatively ambivalent about whether it does matter. We'll talk about that a bit in a moment. But first of all, I want to go through some of the most informative quotes in the piece, because he's talking to lots of people with connections inside and outside the party. And he writes, "MPs complain that he has no politics and that Starmer's Labour has no clear identity beyond bland reassurance. Backbenchers who feel they would do a better job than the shadow cabinet complain that its members are mostly anonymous. In turn, shadow cabinet members complain that it is hard to make an impression when their quotes are stripped of anything exciting or provocative by the party's press office. Starmer's director of communications, Ben Nunn, is widely criticised as remote and inattentive." So you're seeing there similar arguments actually from Labour MPs as we often make on this show, that Keir Starmer doesn't seem to know what he's standing for. That statement about shadow cabinet members struggling to sort of make a splash because all of the interesting lines get taken out of their speeches is especially notable, I think, as well as a direct attack at one of his most prominent staffers. On the other hand, Bush also pushes an accusation of opportunism against Keir Starmer's leadership, writing, "Labour's proposal that teachers should be vaccinated before or alongside at-risk groups has been rejected not only by the government, but by its scientific advisers and the Labour government in Wales, on the grounds that it would risk more lives and would not significantly reduce the likelihood of transmission in schools. For all that the idea is popular with voters, most of the coverage it attracts is hostile, and the campaign risks tarring the party as opportunistic and unserious." Now, we've spoken about that particular vaccination policy on this show. I actually think it has pros and cons. I think the way it's been handled by the Labour Party is fairly opportunistic. But at the same time, I think there are good arguments to vaccinate teachers as quickly as possible. I want to bring you in, though, Dahlia, because those quotes from MPs, from members of the shadow cabinet, and also he's saying from commentators, there is a consensus now emerging that Starmer might not be up to the job. It's all happened quite suddenly, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, credit to Moya from Galden, because every time I try and think about what phrase encapsulates what is so uninspiring about Keir Starmer, and all I can think about is just wet wipe, because it's just the perfect, like, it's the perfect term to describe, why he's so just kind of, like, icky. It's like an ickiness as well as a kind of, like, spinelessness. But in terms of, you know, whether or not this is actually a leadership crisis, it depends. You know, I've always said that, you know, the main purpose of the Starmer leadership is not necessarily to win favour amongst the public or to build Labour's base, but it's rather to purge the left and to make sure that another left insurgency like we saw under Corbyn is never possible again. Is, you know, structurally impossible. So to change the structure of the party away from one that is members driven and towards one whose power is much more concentrated in sort of private donors and the PLP. But he does need to be seen generally as legitimate in order to be able to achieve those things, and competent in order to be able to achieve those things. So in those terms, we might start to be seeing some cracks in actually the efficacy of his leadership on the terms on which his leadership exists, you know, and whether or not from that kind of centrist base, whether or not he's really the best man for that job that I outlined before. Because, you know, his entire purpose was to kind of build back that legitimacy amongst the commentariat. And, you know, the fact that he is, according to Stephen Bush, maybe losing that is problematic, because he doesn't have any source of power. Because normally I would say, you know, losing the commentariat shouldn't matter so long as you build up a base of real people who are really enthusiastic and willing to go out and fight and go out and build the message in their communities and fight for the party. But which is something that Corbyn's Labour kind of failed to realise was the key, or was a key to actually gaining power. But in Starmer's case, he absolutely has no interest in doing that. So for him, losing that kind of commentariat and that kind of palliness with the media does have an impact. But you know, I think the key thing here is that he is coming off as inauthentic and having very poor judgment. You know, and that inauthenticity point, which has been discussed by Ash and by Clive Lewis and all of that on this show, it takes us back to that pre-2015 moment when all you would hear on the doorstep is, there's no difference between the two parties, they're liars, they're phonies, they just tell us what we want to hear. And one thing that made Corbyn so popular in, you know, kind of 2015 to 2017 was that he did break through that. People could say, you know, I might disagree with him, but I appreciate that, you know, both he and I know exactly what he stands for. But that then was weaponized and turned against him. And so, you know, but this attitude, you know, that kind of Brownite, Milibandite attitude of focus grouping rather than movement building, it's outdated and it's a proven failed strategy. And what needs to happen is a harnessing of what drove that initial support for Corbyn and a re-strategizing of how to better deal with the blowback of being seen as principled and honest and, you know, kind of connected to real communities. And, you know, that also connects to the flag waving party question, which is, you know, it shows that inauthenticity, but it also shows incredibly poor judgment, because I don't agree actually that whole flag waving thing is just optics or just aesthetics. I think it's at best intellectually naive, at worst sort of intellectually dishonest to not connect that turn and that leaked report to a rise in reactionary politics around race, immigration, gender, sexuality. And I think that on the left, we sort of pretend that it's just optics sometimes because we recognize that it's not something that you can just message your way out of. The attachment to that kind of particular sort of Little Englandism is not something you can message your way out of. It relates to very deep systemic political and economic crises and how people understand the world around them. So you actually have to do very complex and time-consuming work to push through that. So instead of doing that work, we kind of want to pretend that we can just concede on the optics and yet somehow kind of retain that politics. And that's not possible. And the reason that that is catastrophic as a strategy and demonstrates poor judgment as well as laziness is because people who are driven by that kind of politics to vote, for whom that is the primary motivating factor that makes them want, that decides whether or not they'll vote for one party or the other, they will never trust Labour to deliver what they want on those issues. And that's a good thing. And, you know, but then the people who Labour need to win will read that shift for what it is. And they will see through it and see that it's not just optics. And time again, we have seen, the most recent example is Georgia in the US, that to win in this context, you have to do a long-term work of mobilising the disenfranchised in order to either create new electoral coalitions or build electoral coalitions on new basis and on new terms, rather than trying to kind of recover ones that have been smashed over a very, very long period of time. So I think this whole thing shows poor judgment and it shows inauthenticity as well.
I'd agree with those conclusions. I disagree with quite a lot of what you just said, because I mean, I think you can't just take the lesson from Georgia that you had to mobilize people in urban centers, because also you had to reassure people who'd voted Trump in 2016 and turned against him because of his terrible coronavirus response. And Joe Biden was quite a reassuring face there for people. I think it would be a little bit intellectually dishonest to say the lesson from the 2020 election in America is that centrism doesn't work when you've had a centrist candidate who has won. I think you're going to need a unity between the left and the center. I actually think some reassuring of people who have voted Tory in the past is going to be absolutely necessary. I just think that Starmer needs to also stand for something. That to me seems like the most worrying part of his leadership and what many people around him, be they commentators or MPs or shadow cabinet members, have also realized. Because for me, I do think you're going to have to reassure people who are patriotic. If their principal reason for voting is that they want to strengthen Britain or that they want to wave a flag around, they're probably not going to vote for the Labour Party. But there are lots of people who care about different issues. One of them is they want to be reassured that the person who wants to lead the country also loves the country. So I don't really see the problem with having some flags around. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn had some flags around. I think the real problem here is that Keir Starmer doesn't have anything to add to that. And it's incredibly unhelpful that this strategy document has been released, because what you then get is it's now almost impossible for him to present that as authentic, whilst at the same time, he doesn't have any principles to pad it out. So all you see is this sort of tragic PR display with nothing at all behind it. I don't know if you want to respond to that before I go on to our next point.
Well, I think that to come back to the point about Georgia and, you know, that kind of, I think you're right to distinguish between people for whom this is the primary thing. And that was, I think, what lost the 2019 election to the 2019 election to an extent, in that because it became a Brexit election, you suddenly had a big swathe of the population for whom that was the primary driving force between determining who they voted for. But for that much bigger subset of, you know, people for whom it's maybe one of many factors, but there's also a lot of other things that can potentially trump that, I think that is proved in the fact that, you know, Bernie Sanders does incredibly well amongst Trump voters, which tells you that Trump's base was not exclusively driven by that, populated by people who didn't mind that there was, you know, so I think this whole thing of like, oh, you know, like not all Trump voters are racist. I'm like, okay, but all Trump voters are okay with racism and explicit racism. But the fact that Bernie Sanders is so popular, and Bernie Sanders never, to my mind, very rarely conceded on kind of that point. The fact that he was able to do so much better than someone like Joe Biden did amongst Trump voters tells you that there are definitely other things that we can build on without needing to concede on, you know, that kind of like the politics and in turn the optics, because these things aren't completely disconnected. And while maintaining still like a politics that does not revolve around privileging British people above everyone else in the world.
Michael Deary with a fiver says, given Starmer's history of falling in line with public opinion, how long before he releases a statement criticizing himself? Which is a very good comment, very witty. At the same time, it is worth saying Keir Starmer isn't that unpopular with the public. So he is still more popular than the Labour Party. He is still, historically, compared to other leaders of the opposition, not doing that badly. I think he's got similar ratings that David Cameron did. He obviously went on to, when he was at this stage, of his leadership of the Conservative Party. He obviously went on to win a general election, slightly less than Tony Blair. But, you know, if you're looking at public opinion, there aren't really huge alarm bells ringing, although it does seem like this indecisiveness, this not standing for anything, is slightly cutting through. For me, if I was his strategist, you know, it's not a disaster, but standing for something, if it's, for example, sick pay, if it's, for example, proper support for shielders, if it is, for example, always following the advice of Sage, that's not going to lose you any votes. So it's just going to be, you know, it's just going to go in the plus column and not into the minus column. I want to move on to one more story which was released this week about Keir Starmer. This is one that I think he'll find less electorally worrying, because we know who he think are the stickiest voters. He's most concerned if he looks pro-EU or if it looks like he's not serious about Britain. So this one might not bother his strategist, but it probably should bother us. So The Guardian have reported that Keir Starmer has been urged to give evidence to a public inquiry into undercover policing, as environmental activists have concerns he was involved in a cover-up. Now, what's going on here? So the inquiry which he has been asked to give evidence to, not by the people running the inquiry, but by the activists for whom it is relevant, scrutinizes the deployment of 139 undercover officers to spy on more than 1,000 political groups since 1968. Now, activists have concerns about abuses of power by the police during the period Starmer was director of public prosecution. Starmer had that role from 2008 to 2013. That's how he got knighted. That's why he's Sir Keir. During that time, the time he was DPP, 20 activists were unjustly convicted of plotting to occupy the Ratcliffe-on-Soar power station. Now, those convictions were overturned after it was revealed an undercover police officer had infiltrated the group and then concealed evidence during their trial. So that's why it was overturned, because not all the evidence that should have been available was made available. Now, the undercover police officer in that case, and you might know their name, it was Mark Kennedy. He was one of five undercover officers who was accused of deceiving women into long-term sexual relationships under false pretenses. A really appalling story. You might know of it as, you know, the spy cops scandal. So what does this have to do with Keir Starmer? Well, he was director of public prosecutions at the time. And the complaints in this letter principally concern his commissioning of a report by Sir Christopher Rose into that miscarriage of justice. Now, the report blamed the incident on a junior prosecutor, and according to The Guardian, Rose's report was silent on the exact role played by Starmer during the miscarriage, making no reference to whether, for example, the chief prosecutor knew about Kennedy and the withholding of evidence, or took part in decisions about abandoning what was a major prosecution. So it's left very unclear. How much did Keir Starmer know? We're left in the dark. The article goes on to say the campaigners also list a series of unanswered questions, including whether Starmer helped bury evidence of other miscarriages of justice caused by undercover officers. In June 2011, Starmer commissioned Rose to examine only the case of the activists who planned to occupy the Ratcliffe power station. But by the time Rose's report was published in December 2011, there was growing evidence that the concealment of key evidence in trials of campaigners went beyond the case of the Ratcliffe activists and could have affected a number of other trials. Rose concluded that the Ratcliffe case was a one-off. Starmer accepted Rose's conclusion and said there was no need, therefore, to examine other prosecutions to see if other activists had been wrongly convicted. But then subsequent investigations by campaigners and the media revealed much more widespread wrongdoing by the state, suggesting that many more activists over a number of years had been wrongly convicted. Now, there are obviously quite a lot of unknowns. That's quite a complex story. But the real key issue here is that Keir Starmer commissioned and accepted a report which had conclusions which were wrong. So the Ratcliffe case was not a one-off. The report said it was. So the Ratcliffe case, that was the coal power station, the case into these 20 people who were subject to a miscarriage of justice because of concealed evidence. The report said that was a one-off. We now know it very much wasn't. There were many, many undercover police officers operating in an incredibly problematic, irresponsible way. It's very convenient for the state to pretend it was a one-off. And this is where the real questions come in about Keir Starmer, because when he stood to be Labour leader, he positioned himself as a radical fighting for activists. The idea was that just as he rose to the top of the legal establishment by standing up for what is right, he'd rise to the top of the political establishment by standing up for what is right. However, the evidence suggests that actually, once he gets to the top of the ladder, he tends to make decisions which just reinforce the power of the state, or in the case now he's become Labour leader, reinforce the power of the Labour Party establishment, suspending people without due process, getting rid of his predecessor. So it seems that when you give Keir Starmer power, he uses it to defend and protect the powerful, not the people, not the ordinary people, not the common man. Dahlia, I want to go to you about how worried we should be about these particular revelations.
Cops be copping, right? Like, if it walks like an op, smells like an op, talks like an op, then it must be an op. And this is why, like, I was never convinced by Keir Starmer. I know that there was, like, some on the left who thought that he might be able to kind of harness Corbynism and sort of make it more respectable. You know, but the fact that he was, you know, the head of the DPP, and also, you know, that he never made any effort to engage with the left's institutions the whole time that he was Brexit secretary, just told me everything that I need to know. But this is, again, like the catastrophe of Starmer, which is that, you know, this is one example of, like, where as more and more people's lives get touched by the criminal justice system, especially as mental health services get underfunded, so a lot of that gets outsourced to the police, this disproportionately affects working class people, black and minority ethnic people who should be Labour's base, but obviously are not going to be Labour's base because of these kinds of decisions. You know, whether it's and whether that touches people individually or whether it touches members of their family, things like this are going to lose people who are absolutely essential to a winning coalition for Labour. So when Keir says he's fighting for marginalised people, people will just know that he's inauthentic and they won't trust him, much like the people who are obsessed with patriotism and who vote depending on who sings Rule Britannia with their chest the most are also not going to, you know, won't be convinced by Keir Starmer, by Keir Starmer's flag hugging. So this is all kind of part of a broader sort of just lack of leadership, but also of kind of like just showing his sort of his class interests and where his... how he analyzes the role of the British state as something that punishes, as something that prosecutes, as something that covers its back, even if it means leaving its most vulnerable people in the dark, rather than seeing it as something that should care for people and should take leadership and stand up for people. But this is all, again, part of that broader package of lack of leadership. That, you know, that being scared to depart from what the Tories are doing and just sort of offering it in a slightly like lighter, less bombastic package. And that's why if you go back to the clip that you played at the sort of beginning of the show, when he lied about his comments on the European Medical Association, when you could have gone, you know, wait a minute, like you're saying that this vaccine strategy is this massive success, but in reality, the fact that we are only half vaccinating people, even though this is not, we don't have data to suggest that this is necessarily going to work. And in fact, it could lead to a rise of mutant strains that are resistant to all the vaccines, is precisely an example of the lowered regulations that I was worried about when I pointed out that the risk of leaving the EMA. But because he's so scared, he has no sort of core, no core in him other than power climbing. He doesn't know how to deal with that situation, so he just sort of lied. And that's not going to win for Labour. And not only is it not going to win Labour power, but doing that strengthens the power of the Tories because it essentially reaffirms the terms on which the Tories are gaining power. And it also makes it seem like there's no alternative to the things that the Tories are offering. So it's a lose-lose, essentially.
I should probably say I kind of disagree on the vaccines thing. I think it was advised by the JCVI to leave a 12-week gap between the first vaccine and the second vaccine. There's loads of evidence that that's good for the AstraZeneca vaccine, slightly less that that's good with the Pfizer vaccine. But at the same time, the only reason they tested it with 3 weeks in between the first and the third dose was because they wanted to end the trial quickly. So I don't personally think people should be too worried about the gap in between the first and the second vaccine, but we're probably in a bit of a danger of getting sidetracked now. So maybe we should park that disagreement and that issue for a future show about COVID-19. You can make your own minds up on that one. Simon Bennett with £40. Very kind. Just been paid and my subscription has lapsed. Very, very bad. Please wish my partner, Tasha, a very happy belated birthday and keep up the excellent work. Happy belated birthday to you, Tasha. I hope you had a wonderful day. Boris Johnson has received plaudits recently for committing Britain to ambitious emissions reductions, and the Tories like to claim the country will be setting a sterling example when we host the latest UN climate summit in November this year. However, a decision to allow the construction of a coal mine in Cumbria has now left any claim that Britain is a global leader on climate in tatters. Now, this is based on a criticism which has been made by James Hansen, who was NASA's lead researcher on global warming and whose testimony before the US Senate in 1988 was one of the key moments in sort of raising the profile of climate science and raising understanding and knowledge of the dangers of climate change. A very, very prestigious man. In this letter, he said, an open letter to Boris Johnson, in leading the climate conference, you have a chance to change the course of our climate trajectory, earning the UK and yourself historic accolades. Or you can stick with business almost as usual and be vilified around the world. It would be easy to achieve this latter ignominy and humiliation. Just continue with the plan to open a new coal mine in Cumbria in contemptuous disregard of the future of young people and nature. The contrary path is not so easy, but with your leadership, it's realistic. Very, very strong words there from someone who has an incredibly deep understanding of climate change. James Hansen's criticisms were not isolated either. They echo the objections of the Climate Change Committee. And this is an organisation which was specifically set up by the government to give them advice on how to meet their own climate goals. So they should have a lot of weight when they speak on issues like this. And they wrote to Community Secretary Robert Jenrick last week to say, the opening of a new deep coking coal mine in Cumbria will increase global emissions and have an appreciable impact on the UK's legally binding carbon budget. The mine is projected to increase UK emissions by 0.4 empty CO2e per year. I'll have to ask my guest what that actually stands for. This is greater than the level of annual emissions we have projected from all open UK coal mines to 2050. The decision to award planning permission to 2049 will commit the UK to emissions from coking coal for which there may be no domestic use after 2035. 85% of the coal is planned for export to Europe. Now, as I have demonstrated some of my ignorance about climate science by not knowing what some of those symbols stood for, I'm delighted to be joined by someone who does have immense knowledge about the climate change issue. I'm joined by Adrian Buller from the think tank Commonwealth. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Apparently, Fox actually has the information. It's 0.4 megatons of CO2 emissions per year. I assume you knew that as well.
Yeah, CO2 equivalent emissions. That's the little e under it. But yeah, you almost got it.
Okay, I knew we'd need your expertise on that one. My first question for you is that the government say, you know, this isn't coal which is being mined for coal power. It's not a return to coal power plants. What this is that we need to use coke for a specific process to produce steel, and that at the moment there is no alternative to using coke to produce steel. So either we mine it in Britain, or we just have to import it to burn it in exactly the same way that we would otherwise. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, they've given a lot of justifications for why this is a good idea. One is that, you know, making steel from coal is currently our only method, and the other is, you know, job creation in the midst of COVID economic fallout, both of which actually really don't stand up to scrutiny if you try and sort of begin to poke holes in them. So on the, yeah, it's absolutely, it's metallurgical coal, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's used to produce steel. But ultimately, already at this point, you know, they've committed to 85% of it being exported. So it's not going to make that much of a difference to the fact that we already import, you know, the vast majority of our steel from Australia and Russia, as well as a little bit from the US as well. I think it's like a third each, roughly. And so it's not going to make a huge dent in that, given that we're committing to like exporting the vast majority of it to Europe. So in terms of like security of imports, it's not huge. And then, you know, there's plenty of it to go around. The UK steel industry is already, you know, not producing a huge amount after you had, you know, collapse of British Steel in 2019. You've had both Tata Steel and Celsa seeking bailouts as part of, you know, COVID-19 and its impacts, you know. It's not the highest priority for us to be like increasing our amount of coking coal. And, you know, the biggest thing for me is that we need to be, you know, if we have any kind of stake in actually reducing our emissions, people who say that it won't have a huge impact on emissions are talking about the like process of producing it, which is so negligible compared to the impact of actually burning and using it, which people are just willfully ignoring when they make that argument. And so to have any chance of even coming close to our own carbon targets, which in my opinion are already not stringent enough, you know, as you pointed out, the Committee on Climate Change says we basically need to stop extracting from this mine at the latest by 2035. And they've committed it with the license up to 2049. So you've basically left this almost 15-year kind of hangover where you effectively legally can't be extracting from it, which means any jobs or any kind of benefits are by definition temporary, and you're just going to have this cliff edge in 15 years anyways. And so it just doesn't make any sense when you could be investing in, you know, the very necessary process of decarbonizing steel, which is something we could be leading on.
Is that a plausible technology which would be around the corner with the appropriate government intervention? Is there a way of decarbonizing steel production so that we don't have to use this coke?
Yeah, so funnily enough, Commonwealth is actually putting out a report on this next week, so watch that space. But aside from that plug, absolutely. So, I mean, a lot of these technologies are sort of nascent in a similar way to, you know, carbon capture and storage, but there are groups that are really leading on it. So there's a company called Hybrid Steel, which is sort of a Swedish-Finnish public sort of invested and public-led program to switch to hydrogen-based steel production. And it's, you know, had a lot of early success. And basically, you know, Boris Johnson's entire rhetoric is his climate politics are very much technocratic and based in us being technological leaders. And, you know, I have my issues with that. But even if he wanted to be true to his own agenda, this is exactly the kind of thing that they should be pursuing. This is, you know, leading on the technologies that we need. Steel is inevitably going to be a part of, you know, building renewable infrastructures, et cetera. The fact that we would sink a ton of money and temporary jobs that are going to be lost into a dying form of production rather than investing in what needs to, you know, happen to change in the future is nonsensical. And I think, you know, within the cabinet, you've seen so much disagreement and outrage at Genrec that reflects how nonsensical a decision that it is.
Why do you think they are doing it then? You know, from a sort of political electoral perspective, it does seem like the government are quite serious about painting themselves as leaders in the green economy or whatever. And I know you've said you don't think the targets they've set themselves are ambitious enough, but yeah. I mean, they are ambitious compared to other countries. So it does seem like the government are putting a bet on, you know, green transitions as something which are worth their while to at least be seen to be committed to. So why then would they invest in this coal mine, which presumably isn't going to add that much to GDP? I mean, Thatcher shut them down because they weren't particularly you know, productive sources of wealth or whatever. Also, she wanted to destroy organized labor. That's a different story. Why would they have approved this?
Yeah, so I mean, it really came down to Robert Jenrick, right? So he effectively made this decision, apparently not only without the consent, but without even the knowledge of other, you know, members of the cabinet. And it sparked what seems to be, based on, you know, press leaks, as much as you can trust those, a lot of internal division, because it is a foolish decision in terms of optics as the host of COP26. Economically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. In terms of job creation, even the company themselves has said, like, at most, this might create 500 jobs, which, given the amount of sort of impact, how bad it looks, and the fact that those jobs would probably fall apart long before the mine says it will be open because of, you know, our carbon targets, economically, not a big impact. So I think it really just was something that was absolutely a cock up, if you like. I can't. You think that,
did he sit next to the wrong person at a fundraiser? Maybe.
It seems to be how lots of generic decisions are made. Exactly. So I mean, I don't want to say that because I don't want to get sued. But effectively, yeah, I would say it comes down to that. You know, he said that his justification was, oh, this should come down to the local councils to decide. But it really felt like it was directly encouraged, and there was really no scrutiny of the decision or any kind of like assessment of how it fits into any of the, you know, other plans that we have when it comes to the climate crisis. And it's just, yeah, completely just a stick in the mud. And I think, you know, he's paying for it, and as he should.
And can we finally look forward to COP? Oh my God, I'm going to display my ignorance now. Is it COP26, right?
26, yeah.
COP26. Yes, I got it right. Can we look forward to COP26? Obviously, it's being hosted in Scotland. The government are making a big deal about the fact that, you know, they are going to be playing a leadership role in negotiating the next phase of the Paris Agreement. Is that true? I mean, what role will the British government be playing in those negotiations? And also, what should we be looking out for and hoping for in COP26?
Yeah, I mean, the COP presidency is a really important position because, I mean, it sounds a bit ridiculous, but ultimately, like, your ability to host and to get everyone, you know, to get along with each other has a huge impact on how these things go. And that made a huge difference in Paris. They just took a communications and like PR course so that they could make those negotiations work and come out with the Paris Agreement. And so the presidency is a huge role. And I don't think that right now we're particularly equipped for it, because in order to have the legitimacy that it takes to sort of take control of those negotiations, have people take you seriously as the president and sort of follow the initiative that you're setting in a really, really important year. If COP26 goes ahead, this is when we sort of ratchet up the nationally determined contributions, the NDCs that countries have made in terms of their own, you know, voluntary commitments under this agreement. So it's a huge sort of landmark year, and the Biden administration is rejoining. And so in theory, this could be something where the UK has an enormous role in driving forward the global climate agenda, making everyone's commitments much more stringent. But if we're doing this kind of garbage and sort of constantly undermining our own credibility and legitimacy, it risks, and you know, this isn't an overstatement, it risks undermining the potential success of the conference as a whole and sort of the level of ambition that everyone else sort of comes with.
Adrian Buller, thank you so much for joining us this evening and giving us all of your incredible insight. There was so much detail. I feel like you really understand the climate and steel. I'm very impressed.
I love it. You know, I just love decarbonizing steel with hydrogen. I don't know what to tell you.
Sick. Well, I hope we manage it, you know, and I look forward to your report coming out.
Yeah, All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Dahlia, I want to bring you in on this for the political angle. Do you think this is something that's going to stick to the Conservatives? They're sort of trying to move away from them being the nasty party. They're supposed to be the party, you know, which is both economically responsible, but also serious about the climate. Is them opening a new coal mine something which is going to cut through? Or is this, you know, a bit of a minority pursuit, paying attention to what mines do and don't get built?
I mean, there's plenty of potential for it to be used that way. And again, if the opposition had any sense of metal or strategy, then they would use that, because, you know, the phoniness of Boris's climate strategy is not just limited to this coal mine, as well as the outrageous audacity that he has to rip off the Green Industrial Revolution from John McDonnell and from the Labour Party, which again, Keir Starmer's just like bent over backwards and let him do that with absolutely no kind of like fight back at all, and no sense of like, oh, you're kind of taking a lead from us. And, you know, but it was always, you know, the climate strategy of the Tories with this coal mine, but also, outside of this coal mine, it was always insufficient and it was always merely pageantry. It's nowhere near this idea of being a climate leader. It includes things, you know, like net zero by 2050, which is 3 degrees of warming, which is well past, you know, the tipping point that has been highlighted in reports by the IPCC. And it would cost the lives and livelihoods of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people around the world. And also a lot of his strategy relies on things like on extraction and, you know, things that basically reproduce a lot of the same ecological problems that the carbon-based economy did. But, you know, the scale of investment in his climate strategy is laughably poor and insufficient. And it's not even binding. It's always framed as, you know, an ambition, and it relies on like hypothetical sort of techno fixes that haven't even been developed yet. So you can either take a radical position and say, you know, this is insufficient for the issue of the climate crisis. But even if you want to be conservative, as Adrian says, there's plenty of scope to attack this on the terms that Boris has outlined, because this does fail on his own terms. I think that, you know, activists are building towards that. The climate movement is kind of building towards interrupting and kind of poking a hole and bursting that bubble, as it were, in the pageantry of the so-called climate policy of the Tories. But it would really help if some of that could be shored up by some creativity within the House of Commons, especially from the leadership, from the opposition, sorry.
They're not the most creative bunch, are they? I mean, we might disagree about a number of things when it comes to Labour's leadership, but I think we can agree they haven't sort of come up with any surprises. Boring is probably my most overwhelming emotion. But let's go on to our next story now. Since November, hundreds of thousands of farmers have been camped outside Delhi demanding that new laws deregulating the farming sector be repealed. Now, the protests have been overwhelmingly peaceful and garnered widespread support in a country where 60% of the population make their primary income from agriculture. However, last week saw more violent scenes. That was because when protesters on tractors broke through police barriers. Those protests took place on Republic Day, which is a national holiday that marks the anniversary of India officially adopting its constitution on the 26th of January 1950. On that same day, people stormed New Delhi's Red Fort. Protesters stormed New Delhi's Red Fort, which is a landmark associated with Indian independence, and that caused particular backlash among the general public. However, the protests have continued, and they are receiving international support from unlikely quarters, or perhaps unlikely quarters. Maybe it's unfair to say unlikely. Earlier this week, Rihanna tweeted this news story of Indian authorities cutting internet access around New Delhi. We will also see a tweet of Greta Thunberg, who highlighted the same story, tweeting in solidarity with farmers' protests. This prompted fury on the part of supporters of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, with effigies of the pair burned at pro-government protests. And security services and police have reinforced barricades blocking entry to Delhi while intermittently cutting internet access, electricity and water supplies, as well as using tear gas against protesters. Now, to discuss the latest developments in the mass protests against Modi's agricultural reforms, I'm delighted to be joined by Sukhman Dhami, the co-founder and co-director of ENSAF, a human rights organization that works to end impunity and achieve justice for crimes against humanity in India. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Michael, for inviting me to this conversation.
My first question for you is, we have talked about this topic on the show before, but it seems to have been only escalating since. So these protests have been going on for 3 months. What do you see as the direction of travel? Do the government seem like they might be willing to compromise? Do the protesters look like they might be tiring themselves out? What do you see as happening next?
I don't see either side backing down, frankly. I think the protesters especially have a lot of support and solidarity throughout the country and increasingly throughout the world. This movement is a farmers' movement and a farmers' protest, but they've been joined by labor leaders, union leaders, castes, religions, regions. There's a unity that hasn't existed present in this movement, and I don't see it losing momentum. It actually looks like it's gaining momentum.
And you work in human rights. That's sort of your principal domain. Could you talk a bit about the relationship or the reaction of the Indian state to these protests? Because there's been lots of complaints of basically authoritarianism, them shutting off the internet, police brutality. I mean, you saw those blockades around Delhi. They look, you know, quite severe. This looks like a sort of military occupation almost. I mean, could you talk a bit about how the Indian state have reacted to these protests?
You know, from our observations and according to all reports, there is an escalation in violence, and it appears as if the government is preparing for a larger scale crackdown. We do know that journalists in particular have been targeted, as well as the leadership. For example, there's a case in particular that I want to call attention to. This is the case of Naudeep Kaur. She is a Dalit rights activist, a labor activist, and a women's rights activist. She was arrested, and according to credible reports, she's been sexually assaulted and tortured in custody, and she's been charged with things like murder and sedition and, you know, other spurious charges. There's also been an incident where an individual was shot. Authorities claim that this individual was killed in an accident. However, reporters who have investigated this shooting have in turn been charged by authorities with sedition. Regarding the fortifications and the barricades, we do see a weaponization of these. They've installed sharp metal spikes around these areas, obviously to kind of corral and barricade in the protesters and, you know, likely inflict, you know, serious bodily harm. So I think these are all indications that the government is comfortable with escalating violence, and they're increasingly using censorship of the internet communications. There have been reports that even Twitter's employees have been threatened with serious jail time. So I think there's every reason to be concerned and alarmed. And, you know, I would say that this is a time for the international community to scrutinize India's actions and, you know, perhaps send international observers to make sure that people's human rights are respected.
And what are the political calculations which are being made by Modi at this point? Because, you know, people who even, you know, vaguely follow Indian politics will know of him as someone who is used to, you know, cracking down on protest movements and not having much concern for human rights. But the previous movements that I'm aware of that, you know, he's cracked down on really hard are against minorities, so especially against the Muslim minority in India. Whereas this time around, it seems like he's set himself up in opposition to a group who, you know, make up almost the majority, or basically the majority of the Indian public. I think it's 50% of people who work in agriculture, about 60% of people, their principal income is from agriculture. So he's not repressing a minority here, and it is a democracy. So how's he going to get away with this, basically?
You know, on its surface, this legislation doesn't target minorities, and these farm laws ostensibly apply to the whole nation. However, there are some regions and states of India that are predominantly agrarian and heavily rely on agriculture for not only their economy and livelihoods, but also the very formation of their cultures and communities. And so some of the most heavily affected regions are the state of Haryana and Punjab. And Punjab is one of the regions in India, you know, like you know, other regions in India that could be classified as a minority-majority state. So, for example, in Punjab, the majority of the population belongs to the Sikh minority. So in that sense, this legislation heavily impacts the state of Punjab and therefore heavily impacts, you know, the minority Sikh population. That being said, it also heavily impacts the rural poor and the Dalit community, who also heavily rely on the agricultural sector for their livelihood. And I think in this sense, Modi and his administration didn't anticipate the level of resistance that we're seeing today to this legislation. He has, over the years, tried to woo Dalits who constitute a large portion of India's population. However, all his policies have largely worked to further impoverish them. And this legislation is another example that is going to adversely impact you know, the Dalit community, in addition, you know, to farmers and many others.
Finally, I want to talk about, I suppose, you've brought up the international angle and how, you know, why you think it would be a good thing for observers to be sent in there. And, you know, it seems as if those tweets by Rihanna and Greta Thunberg really did strike a chord. I mean, you saw sort of government agencies make public statements denouncing those tweets. Do you think it is external opposition which Modi is going to be most fearful of at this point in time, or the effect that pushing through these reforms or repressing the protesters could have on India's sort of international alliances that could ultimately be what decides who wins in this conflict, essentially?
I think that is a real concern of the administration. India is sensitive to its international standing and reputation. The world is also aware of, you know, the gross human rights violations that have been perpetrated, you know, recently and in the past, you know, by India's security forces. And there's no reason to believe that its security forces aren't prepared to repeat those practices like enforced disappearances and unlawful killings and torture. We know that in recent weeks and days, for example, India's anti-terror body, the National Investigation Agency, has issued, according to our sources, over 100 notice summons to community organizers, farm leaders, labor organizers. And this is especially concerning because this body and its courts have wide powers to prosecute people on various charges that don't comport with international standards. We also know that, again, according to our sources on the ground, that maybe upwards of 400 people have been detained and their whereabouts are unknown. And so, again, because of India's practices in places like Kashmir and Punjab, we know that police, military, paramilitary forces are more than capable of violating people's human rights. And so the fact that this issue has been internationalized is likely related to India's previous atrocious human rights record.
Sukhmandami, thank you so much for joining us this evening. All incredibly insightful.
Thank you, Michael.
We're going to go on to our final story. The successful rollout of the vaccine means it's at least plausible that within a few months we'll be able to have meetings in real life instead of on Zoom. However, there could be elements of the online platform which we'll miss. I personally have grown fairly fond of never leaving my room. It's quite nice. I can do these shows on here. It'll be nice to go back to the studio. But at the same time, there are clearly downsides. There are also other benefits of having meetings on Zoom. For example, hosts can eject abusive attendees with relative ease, where once a fight might have broken out if it were in real life in a room. On Thursday, a clip of an incident along these lines went viral. This is from a meeting of Handforth Parish Council.
You have no authority here, Jackie Weaver. No authority at all.
She's just kicked him out. She's kicked him out. Don't.
This is a meeting called by two councillors.
Illegally.
They now elect a chairman.
No, they can't, because the vice chair's here. I take charge. Read the standing orders. Read them and understand them.
Read the standing orders. That's been viewed 4.2 million times the last time I checked, presumably a little bit more than that now. Dahlia, have you ever been in a meeting quite that aggressive?
If I have been, it's probably been in local government meetings because
I thought you were going to say, if I have been, it was probably me.
Just me like screaming. Yeah. You know, I think like I think there is this like tendency to like really romanticize like local government and stuff, but without realizing that oftentimes it can be like incredibly charged and like difficult and chaotic like spaces. But yeah, I feel like if I have been in one, it's probably been in like a local government context like this one.
That was a 30-second clip, which went, as I say, completely viral. It's also been like leading the news today. I don't think enough happened today. But there is also a longer video online. So there's an 18-minute highlights video. Very entertaining. I've watched the whole thing. We're not going to show you the whole thing. We're just going to show you some choice segments so you can get an idea of what that anger was about. Why was he so annoyed that the... Well, she wasn't the chair. We'll get to that. It's actually quite complicated.
Not the chair.
She wasn't the chair. That Jackie Weaver hadn't read the standing orders. Right. This is how the meeting starts.
When do we plan to start?
I think we could start any moment, Chairman. I think it's perhaps helpful just to go through the same things as we went through before, which is just to encourage people to switch off their microphones because it does reduce the background. Bing, which tells us that somebody else wants to come in. So I'll continue to admit people if you'd like to start the meeting, Chairman.
So you didn't imagine that. The second sentence said was fuck off. It was unclear if who was saying fuck off to who or who thought they were muted, but it really did set the scene for what was to come. So in the next clip, you'll start to work out what some of the beef was about.
Can we be assured that we won't be thrown out of the meeting like we were last time?
As long as we have reasonable behaviour from everyone, no one would be excluded from the meeting.
I was thrown out of the meeting. So was Councillor Brewerton.
As a point of order, Chairman, could we start them
again?
Chair.
Okay. Okay.
Chair.
We haven't started the meeting yet. Do you want to speak anyway?
I really love the guy. Quite rightly. And then you get Julie's iPad come up, just sort of really, really remove some of the tension. So the man you saw there, whose tag is Handforth PC Clark, and we'll come to that later because he wasn't actually the clerk. Again, another source of controversy. He was Brian Tolver, who is chair of Handforth Council. He is furious that Jackie Weaver, she's sort of the main character of all of this, really, she's been sent to host the meeting by a Cheshire Association of Local Councils on the request of other councillors who had complained of poor behaviour. The next clip we'll show you, I suppose, suggests why those complaints might have arisen.
Are you here as the proper officer?
I am here offering support to Handforth Parish Council in the conduct of this meeting this evening.
You're not the proper officer.
Is that as clerk or proper officer?
There's no difference between clerk and proper officer.
Of course there is.
Yes, there is.
You must know the basic law.
Are we going to start this meeting?
It isn't the role of somebody who, however kindly, volunteers to do the clerking for a meeting to act as a proper officer if they haven't so been appointed. That's against the law.
Has been called by
and let me also quote to you the standing orders of Handforth. But will you stop talking?
Oh my God!
You haven't seen the whole thing, have you, Dahlia? Oh, if you're shocked by that, you're going to keep getting more and more shocked by what you see.
These other bits, I've only seen this short clip where he yells at her. I don't know why, but this is triggering me really hard.
Oh, babe. I really like that line. I'm going to use that before. You don't know the basic law. you don't know the basic law. Because I don't know what he means by basic law. Because do laws apply to the stand? Like, are there laws about the standing orders of parish council meetings? I'm not sure. We'll need a legal expert for that one. I think we have some more poor behaviour here from the elected chair who has provoked complaints.
Points of order, according to our standing orders, are determined by the chair. If you want to raise a point of order as a councillor, you ask if you can raise a point of order, you state it, and then the chair decides. It is not for the clerk to raise a point of order. It is not for the clerk to decide a point of order. And you must be aware of that, or at least God knows what you're doing in your job if you're not aware.
Start this meeting, or shall we elect an alternative chairman?
Oh, hiya. I'm just in a meeting at the moment. Can I give you a call back when it finishes?
A good
reason. Okay, all right, bye.
Julie's iPad, I think, is really the star of the whole show. Because every time you've got like this enormous like tension rising, you just,
she's,
you
know, just this, like, this, hey, disembodied. Hey, I'm not listening.
Yeah, well, because it's not even Julie, it's Julie's iPad. And then you're like, sorry, I'm in a meeting. That's one thing I think I will miss from Zoom meetings. Let's go to where the drama really starts. This bit is a bit longer because this is the real action. This is the best bit of that 18-minute clip.
We'll start the meeting, and I want to repeat what I said at the beginning of the last meeting, that this meeting has not been called according to the law. The law has been broken.
It has been properly
will
called.
Will you please let the chairman
this is what
speak?
Please.
If you disrupt this meeting, I will have to remove you from it.
You can't.
It's only the chairman who can remove people from a meeting. You have no authority here, Jackie Weaver. No authority at all.
She's just kicked him out.
She's
kicked him out. She's kicked him out. Don't.
This is a meeting called by two councillors.
Illegally?
They now elect a chairman.
No, they can't, because the vice chair's here. I take charge. Read the standing orders. Read them and understand them.
Stop. Oh, dear me.
Appalling behaviour.
Chairman gone.
A copy of this will, in fact, be sent to the monitoring officer. Out of those people...
Where's the chairman? Where's the chairman gone?
Like to elect a chairman for this meeting.
You don't have to elect a chairman. There's a chairman already installed. The chairman of the council.
Councillor Birkel, we've been through this.
You don't, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. The chairman of the council is the chairman of the
council.
Yeah, I'm going to subpoena everybody.
Mr. Birkel, could I ask you to be respectful to Jackie Weaver, sorry, please?
Here comes the subpoena!
Chairman?
I want to leave. Just you go and out then. She's kicked Barry out, so I'm leaving.
No, Barry. No, Barry has gone.
Oh, stay.
We're trying to have a Teams meeting, you fool. We're trying to have a Teams meeting, you fool. We can't if you've got that. Oh, you just told us.
Jackie Weaver, I find that the person on Alec Brewerton's Zoom is being very disrespectful to everybody.
Oh, coming from you, from Birkenhead, that sounds good.
My first point is to apologise to Jackie, but welcome to Handforth.
John Smith is one of my favourite ones.
John
one of my favourite characters.
Hero. He's the voice of the audience. Just to be like, what?
Because he seems really impartial. Because the guy on Aled's iPad on the couch, he's obviously sort of, you know, laughing in quite a contemptuous way. Whereas yeah. John Smith is like laughing, but just in a neutral way.
He's our voice in the room. Of just being like, what the fuck? Also, stop doing that. It's like, this is the definition of like power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Because like, clearly being involved in the parish council has completely gone to their head. And I'm like, I'm just very, very scared right now. Is this what's going on in our communities?
Isn't the message more that even a little bit of power can corrupt almost absolutely?
Absolutely, exactly.
You have the almost, I suppose it must have been Aled, if it was Aled's iPad. Yeah, it was Aled, who sort he moved into this sort of golem sort
what
of style
that?
Of speaking where you couldn't work out what he says. We're using Microsoft Teams, you fool! It's fantastic. The whole thing's fabulous.
I'm terrified.
Anyway, Tolva, so he was the chair. He was the chair who was ejected from Zoom, even though Jackie Weaver didn't have the authority. Apparently, she didn't have the authority because you have to have a vote before you eject someone from the room.
She constitutionally didn't have the authority, but spiritually, she absolutely had the authority.
Well, most people's takes on this actually has been that she had the moral authority. And I have to, I do kind of fall down on that side. I think I struggle to have sympathy for Aled or the chair, who apparently hadn't held a meeting for a few months anyway. So I don't know if he'd been doing his chairmanship properly. But I'd seen some arguments from people on the left.
Drama and nothing else.
They were saying, why are we on Jackie Weaver's side? She's the bureaucrat. She's been imposed from the top down to undermine local democracy. And the chair is quite right to be a little bit annoyed, which is the position he has taken. So he spoke to the Associated Press today. Jackie Weaver's been on the airwaves. She's the one getting the platform. She's been on Women's Hour. She's been on Times Radio. But the chair, who is Brian Tolver, he did get to have his say. He spoke to Associated Press and said, I cannot think of any other council meeting anywhere that was taken over by an unqualified member of the public like this. Removing half the councillors from the meeting denied half of the voters of the village from being represented. It was an appalling attack on our democratic rights. The sort of calling her an unqualified member of the public, I suppose, was a bit hard because she was brought in by the local council association of Cheshire. So obviously the sort of larger body had recognized that there was a bit of a problem in one of the units below them. On the request of some of the councillors, they bring in Jackie Weaver to mediate. She attempts that and then lots of people throw a bit of a hissy fit. Are you sure you're on Jackie Weaver's side, Dahlia, or is there a sort of shadow of doubt in your mind that maybe the chair and Aled, with his golem voice, with his subpoenas, he was sending subpoenas, but do you have a shadow of a doubt as to whose side you're falling on?
If I was Jackie Weaver, I would have ejected myself. I would have just been like, you all have issues. It's not my problem. Goodbye. So that was the correct position, I think, to just excuse herself from the whole narrative.
She was chill. If you watch the whole video, she goes on to say, because someone asked, why had the chair written in his little badge, which was quite funny because then she was like, is that a real badge? It was very, they were all completely confused about how Zoom works. But she was saying, no, he's just called himself the clerk, which doesn't make him the clerk. You can call me Britney Spears if you like. She had some wit about her. I think she enjoyed the whole affair, to be honest. Let's end tonight's show there, Dahlia. It's been an absolute pleasure spending another Friday evening in lockdown with you.
Yeah, it's been lovely. It's been a fun show today.
It has been a fun show today, hasn't it? Thank you all for watching and for joining us as you do every Friday, as you should do every Friday. We'll be back at 7 p.m. on Monday. You've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.